Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to the LSE for this evening's hybrid event hosted by the School of Public Policy and the LSE Data Science Institute. My name is Ken Benoit. I am a professor of computational social science in the Department of Methodology. I'm also an advisory board member and former director of the Data Science Institute, and I'm currently also dean of the School of Social Sciences at Singapore Management University, where I am in my day job. I'm very pleased to be joined by a panel of experts on the subject of AI and public policy. We have Helen Margetz, Andrew Murray, Dorothea Shalai, Chloe Smith. We brought them together for this event to mark the publication of the most recent issue of the LSE Public Policy Review, launched just today, which brings together contributions from a range of disciplines, from philosophy to statistics, government, law. We reflect together on the future directions, the applications, and the consequences of the use of artificial intelligence in public policies. So let me tell you a little bit about this event before I sit down and shut up. This event and the special issue around which it's based really come at an opportune moment, because we are at the cusp, if not already in, an absolutely transformative age of AI. AI and data science represent new opportunities to change policymaking in almost all aspects of policy. The capabilities of these emerging technologies, however, are still unfolding, and the need to understand them is not keeping pace. We need to better understand their opportunities, their benefits, and their limitations. This event marks the publication of a special issue of the LSE Public Policy Review, which covers these questions. It brings together contributions from the variety of disciplines that I've mentioned to reflect on the future directions, the applications, and the consequences of the use of AI in public policies. We're going to look through our panelists tonight at how emerging technologies such as AI can transform evidence-based policy through the analytical capabilities, the predictive powers, the real-time monitoring aspects of AI, while also bringing questions about regulation, transparency, accountability, and ethics to the fore. So let me introduce our speakers for this evening. First up will be Dorothea Shalai. She is an associate professor of management of education at LSE. She is the Education and Assessment Innovation Lead and Chair of the AI Policy Group in the Department of Management. She's a recipient of the LSE's Outstanding Teaching Award and a senior member of Advance HE, formerly the Higher Education Academy. She's a core member of the Genial Project, run partly from DSI, which stands for Generative AI Tools as a Catalyst for Learning. Second, we have Andrew Murray. He's professor of law at LSE. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, the FRSA. He's the academic director of LSE's Law, Technology, and Society Research Group, and he's the academic director of LSE Online. Since 2014, he's been a visiting professor at the Amsterdam Law and Technology Institute, and was in spring 2015 and 2017 a visiting professor at the Paris Institute of Political Sciences, or Sciences Po. Third up, we have Helen Margetz. She is Professor of Society and the Internet at the University of Oxford and the Program Director for Public Policy at the Alan Turing Institute for Data Science and Artificial Intelligence. And finally, to round up the comments and offer a bit of a response from the policy world, we have Chloe Smith. She served as a minister between 2010 and 2023, including as Secretary of State for Work and Pensions and Secretary of State for Science, Innovation, and Technology. She was a member of Parliament for 15 years, and she spent a decade as a minister for the Constitution. And she now does advisory work and strategic consulting. And with that, I am going to turn it over to our panelists, starting with Dorothea, and sit down. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So, welcome everybody. I'm Dorothea Shalai. I'm an associate professor of management in the Department of Management. obviously. And today I will talk a little bit about our study that we've done in the last academic year, studying how students use generative AI in their learning. But before I start with that, I must tell you a little bit about how I got in touch with AI and how I got started on this journey of working with AI and also learning about it and trying to figure out what to do with it in academia and education. So I really, the first time when I really started to think about generative AI was around a year ago when I was preparing for my courses and I had this question in my mind, what shall I do? I will face these students and they will be using generative AI already. At the same time, the university was banning mostly the use of AI in the higher education sector. There was a lot of controversy about how we are thinking about these new technologies. So I was really in this kind of double mindset about how shall I go about it? I'm very curious, I would like to innovate, I would like to engage with the students and use it the best way we can for their learning. But at the same time, I was very conscious of the risks that it can pose in our teaching and learning, especially around ethics and academic integrity. But of course, as somebody who is teaching change management, saying to my students, I'm banning you to use generative AI, and then I will lecture you about managing change and how to be open and how to manage resistance would have been a little bit of a hypocrisy. So I thought that I don't really have a chance. I have to embrace it, and I have to jump, and I have to leap, and I have to learn, and I have to work with my students to figure out how we can best use generative AI in our teaching and learning. And so to start the journey, I thought it would be quite nice to have some experts on the team to help my students if I can't answer the questions that are very technical. So this is how I find myself working closely with Dr. John Cardoso Silva and Marcos Barreto and the whole GenAI team, which is here. And we started the GenAI project, which I will tell you about today. So the aim of the project was to figure out how students use generative AI tools, so chatbots like ChatGPT, in their learning and assessment on different courses. The project started in June 2023 as a smaller project, to like a focus group initiative, really. But then grew into this quite large project by January last year, or this year, teaming up with Data Science Institute, Department of Statistics, Management, Public Policy, and student researchers who were helping with the data analysis. We got funding from the Eden Center and the Data Science Institute. And I will not bore you with too much details, but just to give you a little bit of background about some of the courses that we had in this project. So we had a bunch of undergraduate and postgraduate courses in the autumn term and in the winter term. My courses joined the project in the winter term, so last January. And as you see on the table, most of the courses were quantitative courses like data science and statistical courses. And so the management courses were the first courses in the project where students didn't have any coding experience, didn't have any quantitative backgrounds. And so that was quite an interesting way of looking at different types of students and how they approached generative AI in their learning. We had data collection in both terms. In the first term, we only used ChatGPT 3.5 and the free version, so the free version and the free version of GitHub Copilot. And we asked students to do some exercises in their seminars and then fill in surveys, oh, I see John now, about their journey. In the second term, we took a little bit of a different approach. We had more participants and we were more systematic about data collection. So we wanted to make sure that we capture more data. We asked students to create a specific chat log for all their, for the courses that they are participating in, and submit those chat logs to us every week in weekly surveys. And we also had an initial survey, a final survey, and some focus group discussions for students to capture their understanding and their questions and concerns, and especially how they are learning. So these are some of the first insights that we had from this study, but we are still in the middle of analyzing the data, and we submitted this paper in the summer. So these are the very first insights that we had from the data that we analyzed. The first one was that we found that students used generative AI differently for learning and for assessment. Assessment plays such a central role in higher education that it has a significant effect on what students prioritize. And what we found is that students were very much aware of this, and they mostly, at least in our experience, prioritized assessment over learning. So for instance, this quote from one of the students in the focus group discussions underlines this issue. It was like, I solved it first, I got the stress out of the way, and now I can take my time to learn and understand without worrying about like, oh, I have to submit this assignment and it's not working. This was a student on a data science course. So as this quote clearly indicates, students focused a lot more on creating the final product than getting a good grade than really trying to engage with the learning journey. And so one of our findings is that students may bypass critical learning processes by using AI to get the job done, to cut corners, let's say. The second issue is that large volume of readings, pace of delivery, and complexity trigger more generative AI use. So when students find that they struggle to follow the lecture or follow the materials, and there is too much complexity, they turn to chatbots. This week's content was pretty straightforward, and I haven't found myself using AI, was one of the students' feedback on a weekly survey. Another one, if I find it interesting and not too hard to understand, I read it myself. This clearly indicates that when the material becomes more complex, more detached from the student, or it is delivered in a way that they don't understand it or can't identify with it more closely, then they turn to generative AI for help. The next point that we raised is that students often trust AI-generated outputs without scrutiny, because the convincing tone of the chatbots give the illusion of expertise. Now, this might be a problem, and it can be a genuine concern, because for some things you can identify quite easily what is a hallucination, but for other things it's quite hard to do that. So for instance, when Google incorporated AI in the search engine, users quickly found out that Google Search told its users that it was okay, even recommended, I'm sure you heard about this, for humans to eat rock once a day, right? So, and it's very clear that students who would come across something ridiculous like this, they would be very much able to identify that this is absurd, and it's unlikely that they would integrate something like this into an assessment. But validating generative AI outputs in a subject that you are not familiar with, that is more complex, it becomes more challenging. So, first point, students often trust too much the AI-generated outputs without scrutiny. They might also excessively rely on chatbots to help them through the course, which means that if they do that, they can lower the quality of the work that they produce, because they will not have the sufficient understanding to critically analyze the materials. So what we also found is that feedback on the use of generative AI in the course not only improves the quality, but also gives students better judgment on deciding whether they should use AI or shouldn't use AI for a certain task, assessment, or whatever they are dealing with. So for instance, when my students used generative AI chatbots for summarizing management case studies or trying to analyze case studies with chatbots, we found that when they relied too much on the chatbots, a lot of the times they were deviated from their goals and they couldn't answer the question well. because the chatbot didn't pick up on the human elements. It didn't pick up on the human dynamics of politics, stakeholder relations, and a lot of other things, negotiations that matter, that will make an impact, but probably the LLM is not able to pick it up. One of my students after the year said this: through regular exchanges with our course leader, we gained more trust, we embraced experimenting with this technology and learned where it could best support us, where it had been ridiculously unhelpful, and where ethical considerations lay. It was very interesting for me to learn from my students that when I give them feedback on their work, some of them gave up using generative AI for those tasks because they felt that it was not helpful. But others took a different road and they learned more about it and improved their work. There were different strategies, but they were in a better position to make a judgment on their use when they were given feedback. So what should educators think about when they are thinking about policy? Well, first of all, we need to think about how we deliver and evaluate our students' learning. One of our focus group students said, if your question cannot differentiate between a student who actually understands the content and an AI, that means your question is not good enough. And that should make us really think hard about how we are designing our courses and how we are designing our assessments. So, looking ahead, we believe that generative AI is everywhere. It's not something external as it was this time last year. We came a long way. A year has passed, and now it's increasingly integrated into everything in our lives. So labeling the use of Gen AI simply as academic misconduct overlooks the broader question that we need to reform how we teach and what we teach and how we assess our students. In terms of assessment design, we think that we should separate the learning process from the assessed product, so a lot less emphasis on the assessment and a lot more on the learning journey. We should delay the adoption of generative AI tools when introducing a new topic or a skill, because students need a certain basis of understanding, a certain grounding in the subject area, in order to judge whether the AI is helping or not and use it constructively for their learning and for their critical thinking and analysis. And we should also try to map out the process that the students should follow when they are working on their assignments or working their way through the course. Not only because that would allow us to have faith that they have academic integrity and they are not misusing generative AI for their cutting corners, let's say, but also because that way we can support students more in their learning journey. And in terms of curriculum planning, we should guide students in using AI, teach criticism, complexity, and productive failures, and most of all, think about ourselves and learn in collaboration with the students so that we can make this work long term. Thank you.
Okay, good evening, everyone. So, as Professor Benoit said, I'm Andrew Murray, and I'm a lawyer. So, what I'm really thinking about in the paper that I contributed to the collection is where we should be going in terms of developing a legal regulatory framework around the safe deployment of AI in automated decision making in public services, really. So government use of automated decision making. So first I want to start a little bit with the policy context. Earlier this year, the Tony Blair Institute produced a very powerful case for the early adoption of AI in public services. They noted in their final recommendations that after accounting for initial and ongoing costs over the next term of Parliament, the UK public sector could stand to gain as much as £40 billion a year from embracing AI, or as they noticed, proving the perfect arithmetic in the report, as much as £200 billion over the course of a 5-year parliament. Around the same time, or slightly more recently, our new Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, discovered a £22 billion black hole in government finances. Well, the actual number depends on who you believe. It's somewhere between 8 and sort of 40 billion, but it's there somewhere. We have a unfunded spend, apparently, within our public finances at the moment. So in the budget speech last week, she said this: the government are publishing a line-by-line breakdown of the £22 billion black hole that we inherited, which shows hundreds of unfunded pressures on the public finances this year, and into the future too. She has actually indicated, apparently, according to a report in the Guardian newspaper, so therefore it must be true, that she has briefed the cabinet that it could be as much as £100 billion over the course of this parliament that is unfunded. So, going back to our hero in this tale, we cannot afford to leave this on the table. We are 100 billion short. Tony Blair and his institute are going to give us 200 billion. Therefore, as far as I can see, we're all going to be fabulously rich in 5 years' time if we just do what we are instructed to. Okay, so far so good. Why am I here being the critic? Because I'm the lawyer. The lawyer always turns up and spoils the fun. So let me tell you about Charmaine Leisner. I'm sure you all know Charmaine. Yeah, that's not actually her. That's an AI generated, so it's not AI generated. That is a copyright-free image of what is apparently, according to the search term, a Dutch mother. So that's not actually her. But the real Charmaine Leisner, her life changed in 2012. She was a young mother of twins. Everything was going well. She had just finished studying social work and was entering the workplace. She was happy. Her life was going as she expected. And then she got a letter from the Dutch tax authority telling her that she had been fraudulently claiming childcare allowance since 2008 and that she had to pay back the amount that had been fraudulently claimed, which was 100,000 euros. She said in her own words, "Don't worry, this is a big mistake. It'll be sorted out." And it was. It wasn't a problem. 9 years later, after her marriage had broken up, her mother had been diagnosed with cancer and she had fallen into depression and had been unable to work, the Dutch tax authorities said, "Oops." It turned out she was one of tens of thousands of victims of what the Dutch called, and I apologise here if there's anybody Dutch in the room, Toeslagenaffaire, or something close to that. But if you're Dutch and I've just killed your language, I apologise. Essentially, the Dutch tax authorities had used a self-learning algorithm to create risk profiles to spot childcare benefit fraud. The problem was that the training data set led it to make a number of errors, including focusing more on people from ethnic minorities. She is of Surinamese background, and led to basically thousands of false claims being made. Eventually, by 2022, the Dutch tax authorities were fined 3.7 million euros by the Dutch privacy regulator, who said, for over 6 years, people were often wrongly labelled as fraudsters with dire consequences. Some did not receive a payment arrangement or were not eligible for debt restructuring. The tax authorities turned their lives upside down. This led directly to Margrethe Vestager, the European Commissioner Executive Vice President, to observe that this is exactly what every government should be scared of, and led directly to the inclusion of public sector tools being labelled high risk in the European AI Act. Of course, you're all sitting there thinking, well, that's the Dutch, that's the Netherlands. I mean, obviously things could go wrong somewhere else. You know, we're not going to make mistakes in the UK. So, let's talk a little bit about the Home Office's sham marriage triage tool. It was introduced in 2015 as part of a new investigation process for sham marriages under Part 4 of the Immigration Act 2014. Originally, it was called the Dial. It was a bit of a sort of Heath Robinson system using Excel spreadsheets used by the Marriage Referral Assessment Unit. It used data points, such as records of immigration offences, absconding, or individuals otherwise in breach of leave to remain, illegal entry, individuals with criminal convictions, or evidence of links to criminality, to profile whether there was evidence of potential harm posed to the UK by categories of individuals. It was recorded by David Bolt, the independent chief inspector of Borders and Immigration, in his 2016 report that the overall process involved multiple handovers between different IT systems, with each human intervention providing an opportunity for an inputting error. As a result, the Home Office have now sought a more robust system. So that more robust system was eventually put in place in 2019. And an equality impact assessment was released under the Freedom of Immigration Act. This reported that the automated triage process has been developed in accordance with analytical quality assessment and utilises best practice to leverage historic outcomes and associated data on sham marriages in order to identify referrals of couples where there's an indication of potential sham activity. It noted that the tool was introduced in part as an efficiency saving, so Tony Blair would be very pleased about this, noting that the number of immigration intelligence staff required for consideration of referrals was reduced from 25 to 4, and that reduced the time of initial assessment from 14 days to 3 or 4 days. However, one thing to note, compliance with the public sector equality duty under Section 149 of the Equality Act requires consideration of 8 protected characteristics. And here, unhelpfully, the document is redacted and does not give the criteria used in triage. Now, we know that the marriage notification used to populate the data includes information on 3 protected characteristics, nationality, age and sex, but not on the other 5. However, we don't know how that data are being used, and it must be said that in passing, the Public Law Project have challenged the legality of this. So where are we? Well, we're in a catch-22 situation. Don't use AI and automated decision-making in public sector and we all go bankrupt. Use it and we risk mistakes or errors being made. So what do we need to do? Well, what we need to do is use it. I'm not a cynic here. I'm not going to throw my shoes into the works or anything. I'm not a saboteur. I think there is a good reason to use these tools, but we need to use them with guardrails. We need to build the safety systems before we start using it, not 9 years after saying, really sorry, we made a mistake when we sent you a €100,000 request for payment. So I think I identified in paper 5 key areas of risk and harm. They are intransparency and the lack of democratic accountability, which means essentially that algorithms make decisions which are often opaque and unclear. And we need to have some basic principles to ensure that public decision makers who deploy them are able to understand what they are doing and are able to answer for them in a democratic way. There's a risk of bias, error, and discrimination, usually about the data that goes in. There is the phrase, you know, you put garbage in, you get garbage out. So we need to make sure that data sets that we are using are not tainted or filled with errors, which is historically a bit of a problem in some areas of public life. We need to ensure that there are processes to prevent against procedural unfairness and injustice, that people don't just say, computer says no, and that's the end of it. There has to be a process where you can review, where you can check for any unfairness. We need to protect against algorithmic confirmation bias, again, that computer says no knowledge, that the human actually thinks they're in control of this and not the actual AI tool. Because too often people do what the AI tool tells them to do. We heard this from Dorothea just a second ago. Students think because it says authoritatively, it must be true. Well, the same is true of public servants, and the same is true of judges, and the same is true of professors of law. I didn't get AI to write this, but I thought about saying that. And we have to be careful about how automation is used and automating processes that should have checks and stops, so-called human in or human on the loop. So what do we do? So I have a prescription to try and solve this. So I think we need to build a relatively soft but effective set of safeguards. So in terms of dealing with things like intransparency and the lack of democratic accountability, we could start with what I'm calling a transparency impact assessment. This would be a simple document required to be completed before the organization deploying the tool actually deploys it. And it would ask them to some simple questions about explainability, accountability, training data, those kinds of things, to actually record how the system has been sort of bought and deployed in the system. To ensure they remain up to date, TIAs would need to be regularly reviewed and updated. Who might do this? Well, that could be the second person. I think we need somebody called a Decisional Transparency Officer, or a DTO. This would be a senior member of staff in each organisation responsible for ensuring compliance and designated to respond, or through their team to respond, to requests from the public around transparency, decision-making, all these kinds of things. To protect against the risk of bias, error and discrimination, I would like to see a secondary decisional impact assessment. So a DIA would examine and identify risks of bias and error. And allied to this, I think public sector decision makers should allow researchers access to training data and any decisional logic. It's not like there's trade secrecy if you're the government. You're not covered really, or you're not worried, or you shouldn't be worried about making commercial value from this. But if you are worried, this could be done confidentially where there's any sensitive information or commercially sensitive information to be made available. What other things should we do? Well, I think there should be clear and specific protection for whistleblowers and a specific response period for any claims or challenges to bias, error, or discrimination made by whistleblowers. There should be a system of auditing and reporting annually decisions taken by public decision makers. Oh, my screen's gone off. There it is. Decisions taken by public decision makers, and this should be seen and subject to external audit, a bit like the Digital Services Act does in the European Union around platform decision makers. There should be a presumption against automation, by which I mean that automation of outcomes, such as a decision which is made to allow or disallow a particular benefit or access to a service or something like that, should only be done where the decision-making body have been able to show a sufficiently high level of accuracy in the decision-making process. So there should be no automation of outcomes without previously shown high levels of accuracy. Two last things, and I promise, because I'm trying to keep the time short, I might have gone over, I apologise, Ken, if I have, that there should be a specific, separate, independent regulatory body. It doesn't have to be a new regulator. I know people keep saying create regulators, I don't want to create a new regulator. There should be a role for one of the pre-existing regulators, perhaps, such as the Information Commissioner, who should have powers to inspect, investigate evidence of claims, bias, error or discrimination. They should be allowed to make requirements for documentation to be given, shown access to decision-making logic, should be able to carry out reviews and investigations, and if necessary, they should have a power to prosecute before a dedicated automated decisions tribunal. In essence, these last two things mirror exactly how data protection law works already with the Information Commissioner's Office and the Information Tribunal. So I think we need to have oversight, but that's the stop, that's the last stop, that's the long stop. Much better is we need to have safeguards and guardrails in place for the decision makers, which is made up essentially of the first six of these bullet points. So that's the claim I make. I would love to see government using these tools, but please, let's make sure we use them safely and we use them with sufficient recognition of the fact that the public sector is the one area of our life that we cannot choose not to engage with. So we can choose not to engage with Google if we don't like what Google does with AI. We can choose not to engage with Apple if we don't like what they do with AI. We can't choose not to engage with Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. I know I've tried, it doesn't work. They will always find you and get you. So we have to engage with public sector, so we need safeguards. I'll leave it there, thank you.
So I'm going to talk about the paper that I wrote with Omar Guerrero, who's in my team at the Turing Institute. And the paper's called Are All Policymakers Data Scientists Now? Data, Data Science and Evidence in Policymaking. I feel after Andrew's talk, I should put a couple of caveats on that. First of all, you will note that I haven't included AI in the title. We called it data science. Actually, an awful lot of what's called AI is data science. Also, if you come from the Alan Turing Institute, people think that sooner or later you're going to talk about super intelligent killer robots. that are going to destroy the human race, and I really am not, so I thought it better to leave that out. I should give a big shout out to Omar, who's not here. He's on paternity leave. He's had a lovely baby boy, in case you're interested. I should perhaps also say that I'm talking about the possibility of data science for policy making. I'm talking about it as something which can help policymakers with policy making, rather than something that's going to make the policy decisions. I'm not actually talking about bureaucratic productivity, aka Tony Blair. Other papers are available if you'd like a paper on that. I'm not talking about data science and AI for administrative decision making or administrative systems. At this point, I'm talking about decision support systems, really, for policy making. And the first thing to say is that potentially data science could be really transformative for policy making. Why? Because governments have no, most governments have very little tradition of using transactional data about their interactions with citizens and firms, for policy making. If you think about the traditional model of Weberian bureaucracy based on the files, as Weber called them, they're based on the idea of some kind of filing system where you can look up an individual case. But filing systems do not generate any usable data for policy making. And when the first computers came into government, and I wrote my PhD about those here at the LSE, they didn't do anything to rectify that situation, because they really just kind of automated existing data organization systems. They were developed usually by huge global computer services providers like Capgemini or Fujitsu, which actually were perfectly capable of making some of those catastrophic mistakes that ruined people's lives, even without AI. They didn't generate usable data for policy making. So potentially data science could be really exciting in this space. We could see a world where policy, more than ever before, could be evidence-based and data-driven. Because really, if you're not using data science, if you're using kind of the old world, you're the old systems of government, you're really talking about a world of official statistics. Economic indicators like GDP, balance of trade, or a specially collected data like the population census, crime statistics, or very large and expensive surveys like crime, labour force, household surveys. And in fact, in public administration, there's a stream of research on the state's, the information capacity of the state. And there, the information capacity of the state is really based on the state's capacity to do things like run a census or collect these official statistics. That's how we used to measure the information capacity of the state. So there are lots of new possibilities, and I'll say a little bit about some of them. Well, first of all, data science encompasses a whole range of kind of methodologies, some of them new, some of them kind of revamped old methodologies, but all of them offering the possibility to collect and combine new sources of data with potentially old sources of data. So machine learning, large language models, visualization techniques, natural language processing, there's agent-based modeling. There's a whole range of methodologies which offer the potential to get insight from data. And we do find that a lot of older methodologies like sociology, econometrics, complex network analysis, that people who specialize in those methodologies find themselves sort of, or have the potential to find themselves relabeled as data scientists, particularly if they want to earn more money. And we have a greater range of types of data. Yes, we have administrative data, if we can unlock it from those legacy systems. But we also have the digital footprints that we leave around everywhere we go, as we walk down the street with our phones and so on. New ways of collecting experimental data, survey data, much cheaper and easier and more in real time than it used to be. And then there are new ways of creating synthetic data. So there's all sorts of new data possibilities and methodological possibilities. And that can help us, or could help policymakers, model kind of large-scale, complex social systems and help feed into socioeconomic policymaking, fiscal policy, industrial strategy, health interventions, monetary policy. There's all sorts of policies where data science might play a role. In the paper, we look at kind of three characteristics of adoption of these kind of methodologies. One of them is pace. How quickly are these technologies being adopted? Another is penetration. How widely are they being adopted, in terms of policy sectors and domains? And the third is profoundness. I don't know if it should have been profundity, but I'm not sure if that doesn't mean something else. Anyway, the kind of depth. How much are these methodologies helping policymakers to understand the world outside and potentially to change it for the better with a policy intervention? That is, after all, the task of policymaking. How kind of profound are the insight that they give into the world outside? So in the paper, we discuss two main ways that data science might help. One is about improving predictive accuracy. That's what machine learning, for example, is most famous for. And the other are explanatory mechanisms, something that delve into the kind of causal mechanisms or can produce kind of counterfactuals to a policy intervention, that look at the mechanisms that might be underneath any kind of social change that a policy intervention would come about. Now, starting with increasing predictive accuracy. Well, of course, sometimes prediction is really useful. I mean, we know that from on an individual basis, right? I mean, if we wanted to decide to have a policy of carrying an umbrella today, knowing whether it was going to rain or not, it's just a prediction. We don't bother to get ourselves au fait with all the mechanisms behind it raining, particularly me, very bad at geography. We just need to know whether it's going to rain if we're going to carry an umbrella. And sometimes policymaking is like that. So central banks, predict inflation so that they can know how to adjust interest rates. Income forecasts might be used to set benefit rates and so on. There are policymaking tasks that get value from that kind of predictive accuracy. And it is being used quite a bit already across government. We might expect to see quite a lot of variation in the kind of pace in which it's adopted, because some agencies, for example, have huge amounts of data, like the tax authority. They have huge amounts of data. They don't sort of really share it with anyone, but they can analyze it themselves using these kind of methods and improve their predictive accuracy. What about penetration? How widely is it used? Well, there are challenges. This is a technical task. It's not the kind of thing that civil servants tend to have been trained in. But it's kind of possible. We've seen it with statistical. This, after all, is statistics. If we look back in the past, in the last couple of decades of the last century, we saw statistical methods like regression and correlation kind of widely adopted by government departments. So we can see that kind of adoption possibly in the future for kind of prediction techniques and machine learning. But when it comes to profoundness, then it's more debatable. these kind of techniques, they're kind of shallow. They don't change the way that policymakers think about the world. For example, if you're using a machine learning method to kind of predict cost of living and understand what benefit rates should look like, you won't know what difference the benefit rates would have on benefit recipients in terms of their looking for work or job seeking. You wouldn't know that. You wouldn't have any mechanism to do that. So in terms of profundity, it's not very dramatic. Now, let's think about the second set of methods that I talked about. Methods that have some kind of explanatory mechanism. Well, here, pace and penetration are really hard. First of all, there's the question of data unavailability. There's all kinds, just because you've got data science doesn't mean you've necessarily got data. A lot of data is locked in those legacy systems. Even now, Fujitsu has control over a lot of the post office data, for example. Also, if you're looking for explanatory mechanisms, you quite often have to overcome kind of canonical assumptions about the way policymakers do things, like economic equilibrium or something like that, something that's a real challenge to people who have used certain sorts of methods for many years. And there's real technical limitations for these kind of methods as well, in terms of being able to work across having domain expertise and technical expertise, working across sectors, across disciplines, economics and health, for example. And I'll illustrate that with an example from the pandemic. So think of the pandemic. So during the pandemic, there was loads of discussion of data. Politicians were showing PowerPoint slides of graphs. And so data scientists, we should have been so happy during the pandemic, you'd think, huh? But actually, when you think about it, they were all really epidemiological models. There was incredibly little economic modelling and incredibly little modelling that actually crossed, sort of identified the complex interdependencies between different policy areas like health and the economy, for example. I mean, you can't, if you lock down the economy, then you might think that that's going to preserve the spread of the disease, and we're presented with these kind of trade-offs. But actually, if you leave the economy open, people still change their behavior because they're worried about the virus. So we couldn't encapture those, and there's a lot of policy making without any evidence or any understanding of what would happen. Furlough schemes in particular were introduced with very little idea about what were going to be the long-term effects of that on things like labour mobility, people's ability to move across different jobs and so on. So some of what this kind of modelling would involve would be trying to get the kind of models that would help in that kind of situation. Omar's actually working with the Department of Business and Trade to develop a model of labour flow networks, the kind of model that you would have liked to have during the pandemic. That's what we're talking about here. So these are difficult things to roll out. These are they require policymakers to have quite an advanced understanding of the possibility of these kind of methods, to understand things like multi-agent modelling, which is what Omar uses, and Bayesian inference and things like that, as well as having the rich domain expertise that you need. So there's quite a lot of barriers to this kind of modelling, but if you can do it, there's a lot of possibilities. There's a nice example of this kind of modelling from the Canadian Central Bank, who've developed a macroeconomic model that has kind of realistic cross-sectoral features of some parts of the economy. And that allows both explanatory power and more greater predictive accuracy. Omar has developed a model which is used in many developing countries now in conjunction with the UNDP, which looks at these complex interdependencies between policy areas and tries to understand and helps developing countries think how to meet their sustainable development goals by working out how to optimize their resources across policy areas. Really simple example. You might think to improve the education system, you need to put as much of your resource as possible into education, but sick children can't study, so it may be that you should be putting some of them into health. Really simple example, but there are hundreds of policy areas that have interdependencies like that. That uses a multi-agent system as well. So have we seen a complete transformation of the state's information capacity? Really not yet. Think of another example from the pandemic. Think about inflation. We measure it in a really traditional way. The consumer price index is measured at sort of 141 stores collecting data. Very difficult to do during the pandemic, impossible actually. That is a sort of custom built statistic. There could be really exciting ways of measuring inflation. We could have a kind of personalised inflation measure. The food campaigner Jack Monro has suggested that actually inflation affects different people in really different ways in a cost of living crisis. The first thing that stores take off the shelves are kind of two for one bargains and things like pasta. And people on very low incomes are affected far more by those kind of shifts than people on high incomes. So it would be possible with the kind of data that was collected during the pandemic, private firms became much more generous with their data to do that kind of thing. But we're quite a long way from it, I think, although the ONS are thinking about it. So that's all really, I mean, challenges, I think have been mentioned a little bit by Andrew. Garbage in, garbage out. You don't get good results from really poor quality data. It's obvious, we know that in all sorts of areas of our life, but it's a real challenge for data science. And data sharing is also a real challenge, because if you want to look at interdependencies, you have to get data from different parts of government. And of course, some of the data is still locked up in those legacy systems where I started. I wanted to end on a positive note. One thing is that policymakers are really interested in data science and AI. When I wrote my PhD here at the LSE, literally nobody was interested in it. Well, my supervisors, are not here, but they were interested. And gradually the rest of the world, you know, here you all are. But government were not interested in any kind of computer technology or the kind of things we're talking about. And we have seen a huge shift in that. There were 400 mentions of data science and AI in government press releases and publications in 2022, compared with almost nothing in 2015. I think we are seeing a shift, going back to the question of the title. I think we're seeing a bit of a shift with the new government away from AI towards data science. AI was mentioned 42 times in the spring budget, and only three times in the one that we've just had. So I think we are moving a bit to focus on those questions of data and digital technology, which are really important too.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Right, good evening everyone. It's really nice to be with you. I'm not the academic on the panel. I've been asked to unite to share some of my experience from government, and I'm speaking really not only as having been a lawmaker with experience of how you do these things in law and in regulation for 15 years, but also I've been a minister, first of all in the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, which is where we would locate regulation of AI, and I'll come back to that a little bit later on. But secondly, in a very large operational department. Operational is the word that they use inside government for the big ones. DWP is the one I'm talking about, which has a budget of, you know, 200 billion plus and staff of approximately 80,000. It's big. The other biggie in that sense is HMRC, which got a mention with honour in Andrew's presentation. Just for good measure, I've also actually been the minister responsible for the Office for National Statistics, so I might be able to bring that into a couple of points that Helen made. So I really wanted to, first of all, welcome all three of the contributions tonight, and as I understand it, there's even more in the publication. It's so good to hear, you know, going in order, I mean, from Dorota, a really, really personal but also pragmatic application of this question, this learning question in a learning environment. And I really admire you bringing that into this context. Although I think I agree you have to. There's almost no choice in doing so. Andrew, thank you very much for, a nice punchy piece about where some things go wrong, badly wrong, and some practical suggestions for change, and I'll come on to some of those in a second. And Helen, thank you so much. You've really given us some richness, and I'm going to go with profundity for some of your points. So I think, first of all, we have to really think about and acknowledge the problems and the trade-offs, and actually those were presented in all three papers tonight. Obviously, the questions of cost, and Andrew, you brought those out very clearly. But the question of volume and complexity, and Dorota, you kicked us off on that, and I think we've all seen that. In whatever our field of work may be, there will have come a time when there's just too many line items coming through whatever the system is that we use, and we ask for help. We seek a tool to help us do that, and so we've got a particularly large version of that in this debate here. But Andrew, I think also buried in your presentation was a very, very interesting point that not only do we experience error from machines, but actually humans commit error as well. And you, I think, had a particularly good example in your home office point. You said that each human inputting provided an opportunity for error. So let's not think that this all falls, as it were, on one side of the sheet. There's a real trade-off there between machines and human ability. Helen, you brought us into the realm of skills, and I thought the trade-offs there are very, very obvious, actually, in terms of how you want to marshal your public service, your civil service, all the professions that make up what we ask the state to do. That's on the move, and that's changing, and you led us through that. And something that seems to me particularly important that spans contributions here is about accountability, and I think we'll probably return to this again and again, obviously. And we can think of accountability per each individual decision, and Andrew's work took us through that. But actually there's something really big in the democratic context there as well. So tempted though you might be to design the perfect expert system that can do all these things, one thing that we have in the British constitution, such as it is fireability. And that's pretty important. If you think your government, your prime minister, whoever it may be, has done it wrong, or in the case of the US, let's shout out to the fact that they're doing this exercise as we speak, that's really, really important. That's a big form of democratic accountability, and you might want to be cautious about trading that away in favour of a system that does not have human politicians involved in it. I just wanted to touch on a couple of the tools that are already there when we look at these problems in government. And certainly I've had to eyeball a couple of these issues. Andrew's focus on automated decision-making was something that I looked at closely whilst I was leading the Department for Work and Pensions. And again, the trade-off is really clear and obvious. You know, you are responsible and accountable for running a system that is not overly costly, but you must take each decision fairly and with full compassion for the circumstances of people's lives. And there were certainly a couple of instances while I was there where the choices involved, the trade-offs and the options involved came clear. Also an example from DWP that might touch on some of what Helen was pointing out around automating of decision-making. There is an obvious one actually in public policy that some of you may be familiar with. So for example, you could automate not only benefits uprating, but also the age at which the state pension kicks in. Now, we in the UK don't automate that. That is still left in the realm of political decision making. In other words, it's for the Prime Minister of the day to do it. And usually you aim to gain consensus over that, because obviously those decisions have to last some time. But actually, there are several other countries, and I think I'm right in saying it's an increasing number of countries that have chosen to automate that, and that becomes a rolling, a ratchet, effectively, year by year, depending on other life cycle data. So let's go into tools. Every minister has to use a thing called the public sector equality duty. And this one's quite important. There's a general part of it and there's a specific part of it. Many of you will already be familiar with it. But what it makes sure that you do is, first of all, that your decision-making must not be unlawful against existing law. Secondly, that you must advance equal opportunities. And what they mean by that is between those that have the so-called protected characteristics and those that don't. And thirdly, foster good relations, again, between those that have those characteristics and those that don't. Now, a good minister will actually be using that framework every time they are looking at a policy and how to design a policy, and I hope they use it really wisely. Another tool that is already out there that is relevant to this was in the AI white paper that was published in 2023, and it was part of my responsibility at the time to handle this in Parliament and to talk about the principles that we set out there. And those were highly relevant to the points that have been raised tonight. Safety, transparency and explainability, fairness, accountability, and then finally contestability and redress, which I think you'll agree goes right to the heart of some of the points. So those principles are well in use already in public work, and I hope they stay that way. And I wanted just to point out, for those who are keenly looking at fresh legislation, there is a piece in the data usage bill. So this is, if you like, a revised version of a data bill that has had a couple of attempts at making its way through Parliament, and the new government is bringing it forward again. There's a vehicle in there, actually, for exactly what Andrew has been thinking of and talking about, which is how to review automated decision making. So that might be one that you wish to take a look at. That looks like a move to say, hurry up, so I will. What I wanted to just go to next was then the point about silos. And Helen, your work really inspires this thinking. You remind us that we have to take the state out of the silos that it so easily falls into. And again, I hope that opportunity is gripped for the spending review in particular. That's the vehicle for doing that in the next 6 months or so. We've had the budget. The next step of that is the multi-year spending review. And that's where you get to really think about, do you need 100% of data scientists, or do you need 10% of those and 90% of something else, and so on and so on. A broader point is that I think institutions will find it generally quite hard to keep up against some of the measures that we've set out tonight. And I mean, when I say institutions, I mean the departments of the state. I also mean Parliament itself, which needs to have a clear scrutiny function. That scrutiny function leads us to some other helpful reference points, and I'd recommend a report to you that was produced by the Public Accounts Committee last year about big nasties, and they called it the big nasties, capital B, capital N, in public spending, of which legacy systems was one. So Helen, you'll be taking a close look at that. I think what we've seen from all of the papers tonight is that actually we are all in this challenge, whether we're as students or as tutors, or whether we're as regulators, or whether we're as citizens, or whether we're as civil servants trying to aid all of those things. We are all challenged by these shifts and by the dynamic move that is represented. So I just wanted to then close off by saying we've come some way on the subject of regulating AI. I think that's a sort of point between the lines for tonight's session. I mentioned the white paper already. I mentioned the way that whilst I was at the department, we were charging regulators with setting out guidance in each of their areas. There is, I think, an argument that is open and available to have as debate about how much that ought then to be codified in law. I think we can be cautious on that front. I'm going to suggest that the quite universal, very expansive EU approach hasn't got it all correct and leaves open many, many more questions, as just as many as it tries to write down on the page. There's more to come as well in the industrial strategy, as well as the spending review, which is where I think you'll see the state trying to pull together technology as an enabler of other things, of public services, as well as having to grapple with all of the questions about the digital centre of government in its own right. I'll pause there.
Thank you very much. All right. Thank you, panelists. We are now going to open the floor to questions from the audience. That will happen both here and online. Okay, we're going to start off with an online question. So this is from Sonia Wolf, an LSE visitor. These are questions for panelists Murray, Margetts, and Smith. Are there examples of AI use in policing, and what problems has this generated, and how might they have been avoided?
Yes, predictive technologies have been used in policing, particularly in the US, and it rather sort of embodies the need for a list. Andrew showed a list. You mentioned a list that there are a lot of kind of lists of principles that you should embed in any use of AI and data science. And they're mostly quite good lists, and there are four things which always appear in these lists. One of them is this question of fairness and bias. Wherever there is AI, there is a risk of increase in inequity. Wherever it comes, there is always a danger of that, which you have to watch out for. Another one is accountability. Who's responsible? That is an increasingly difficult question about any use of AI, particularly with things like large language models and ChatGPT and things on, because they can be, there's a sort of foundation model, and then there's a fine-tuned version of that, and then there are applications based on that. Who's responsible when it goes wrong? It always disperses, AI always disperses accountability. You mentioned the question of transparency and explainability. That's a real problem. These can be black box technologies. Actually, the first category of things, the sort of prediction technologies that I talked about first, which are the kind of things that they're using in the police, not, of course, the second mechanism, but the first, always tend to be not very transparent. They tend to be black box, often sold by rather unscrupulous companies. Those are the key things that always come up, and they're particularly important when it comes to policing, because almost all data in the criminal justice system is somewhat biased, is biased in some sort of way, and AI reinforces the bias.
I'll add a little bit. I'm aware of time, but I think all these safeguards I said we need to have for automated decision making in public sector decision making go double for the police and law enforcement, because that is the one area of life where your liberty is at stake, and I think we want to make sure they're using their processes as fairly and as reasonably transparently as possible. They can't always do that, because sometimes they need to use it for intelligence-led policing, and you can't tell the criminals what you're doing. But that aside, I think it's very important that we have sufficient safeguards. Because as Helen says, the risk is embedding in pre-existing bias and error. The problem with any data set is it's historical. So any data set is capturing what has happened and then making a prediction about what will happen. And this is something we need to be very aware of, especially in predictive policing or in decisions about bail or things like that, or in automated facial recognition, that what we're using is historical data to predict future patterns. Now, as Helen says, these systems are getting better, and they are probably in many cases outperforming humans at doing that. But we need to be aware, particularly where we're using things like historical records of criminal activity within areas or regions, to then populate risks of future criminal activity, that we may be capturing other things in a kind of postcode lottery. So we have to be very careful about that.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm Dhruv. I'm an undergraduate here. I think you all talked about explainability, and of course that's a big issue with a lot of these black box neural network models. But particularly with biases and things like that, which are hard to understand, how would you recommend, from maybe a technical perspective, we tackle this explainability problems? Do you kind of sort out the current kind of ANN models, or do you shift to new kind of models altogether? Because this is a very prevalent problem across the field.
Okay, let's take another question. How about you, young lady in the black shirt there?
Hi, yeah, so I work in the private sector, and I would love to hear your opinion on the relation between AI regulation in the public and the private sector. Which one do you think should lead? How they should learn from each other? And milk.
Okay. How about you over here with your hand up high? We'll get back to you shortly.
Hi, my name is Tom. I'm an AI engineer at a startup relatively close to here. And my question is, particularly picking up on Dr. Salai's point, to what extent, in absolute terms, have the LSE students' grades increased post 2020 and post GPT?
Okay.
There's just one point I wanted to make about on the explainability question, so thank you for that question. It's not a technical point so much as how you might do it as a lever of the state. And I just wanted to point to the work of the global safety discussions that have been going on. And these have essentially been about should states, and if so, how, force companies to reveal the workings inside the box. So the UK has had, you know, something of a leading role in this with the AI Safety Institute, which I was involved in setting up. And I think you'll see more evolution on this point actually through legislation that's shortly going to be introduced to Parliament, which will be seeking to put the work of that institute on a statutory footing. So you'll see much a lot of this be worked out publicly, although whether it's capable of being, again, written down into words on the page, which is how you have to do law, that will be, that may be somewhat challenging. Can I just briefly say a point on the distinctions between public and private? And thank you for that question. My aspiration would be that there shouldn't be distinctions between public and private. What's good for one has to be good for the other in law terms. For what it's worth, I think also in public spending terms. And I'm thinking of national insurance, for example, on public bodies or private bodies, which is a topic from the budget just passed last week. But I would like to suggest that actually there ought not to be a distinction, if that's what your question was getting.
I'll take one or two, and I'm going to leave definitely question three for Dori, because that's her expertise, and I'm fascinated by the answer as well, actually. Might change how I set my exam questions. But I think the main question I think for me to address is that relationship that Chloe's just dealt with between public and private. I mean, AI tools, hopefully, will be general purpose tools that may be then deployed through a specific lens. Therefore, there should really be no distinction between whether we're regulating the public or private sector, except, as I say, in the one particular aspect that we can't choose not to engage with the public sector. So we do have sometimes additional safeguards in the public sector, such as judicial review, for example. So accepting the sometimes need for additional safeguards about deployment in the public sector, good process is good process wherever it's found. And the whole point of regulation is to design or encourage good process and safety in that process. I think we saw with the Post Office Horizon scandal, as Chloe's pointed out, that we can have as many mistakes and errors from private bodies as from public bodies. Also, just to say very briefly, I don't think the European AI Act is necessarily the way to go. I think this very slightly cumbersome form of regulation that the European Union has adopted, I think they might come to regret that in 1 to 2 years' time, as the technology rather overtakes the speed at which they can keep it up to date. And so one of the things I would say that the UK government has arguably got a better position on is the kind of policies-based regulation that we have through the White Paper, which gives it a much nimbler approach and gives the regulators more power. So I think I would say that. And I would just say one very quick thing very quickly on explainability, which explainability is not a panacea. Transparency and explainability are tools to help us better understand and to design better regulation, but it's not a panacea tool on itself. We need to employ it in partnership, I think, with something else to make it effective. Okay. LEC students.
I love the question. I'm sure I will make statistics for you for the next lecture, because I think it would be very interesting to see the actual data. Obviously, we don't have the data. And I think it would be quite difficult to measure as well, why
if there was a shift, what was the shift and what triggered the shift in grades. But I think your question really relates to this idea about students bypassing learning and therefore getting maybe higher grades or passing courses that they might not pass otherwise without the use of generative AI, if I understand it correctly. And I think here what we have to think about is how we design our assessment and how we design our curriculum. And we are working continuously on figuring out what are the tasks and the methods or assessments that are really exposed to the use, to the negative use of generative AI. And a lot of our colleagues are shifting back to exams to test students in a controlled environment if the task requires it, if that's the best way of teaching. But for a lot of skills and a lot of knowledge that we want to convey to our students, also preparing them for the labor market, we need to also work with the students to give them the opportunity to engage with these new technologies and integrate these new technologies into our assessments. So we are continuously evaluating our assessment methods and thinking about what are the best ways of measuring learning and evaluating learning, and what are the best ways of helping our students to gain the most of their degrees. One thing that I could say that we've seen, but this is not justified with data, is that of course, since maybe last year, since the ChatGPT became a household name, we've seen an increase in, especially in English language universities, an increase in quality in the language of the assessment. So that's definitely there. On the other hand, I'm teaching a management subject and I've seen a lot of very bad quality assessments, beautifully written, not making any sense whatsoever. So a lot of my students actually did worse when they used generative AI. We called it in the paper, if John is still here, mindlessly. Because if you just use it mindlessly, yes, you will create a beautifully written paper, essay, or whatever it is, but it will not make sense, it will have holes in it, it will not be solid, and it's definitely not going to be innovative and something that meets the criteria for a high grade. So you might not fail, you might pass, but to get a good grade, at least with the current technologies, you really need to study. I don't know what I will say next year, but for now, it's not enough to get a really good grade at LSE.
Helen, did you want to add something to that?
It was only on the regulation point. I mean, the thing about AI, most technologies, but AI in particular, is that it's a horizontal technology. It gets into everything. So every single market has the potential to be changed and shaped by AI. And that means that every regulator needs to understand AI. Every regulator is a technology regulator now. But it's also a vertical technology, and we just see education is a really good example. So the implications in education are really distinctive. I mean, because they're forcing us to rethink the way we do assessment and all sorts of other things. And that you need domain expertise to understand that. So it comes back to the point I was making about the kind of expertise that policymakers use, this kind of complex mix of expertise from multiple domains and technical expertise. And really sort of policymaking teams, I think we should be talking about, who somehow combine, because you can't get all those things in one person. But the same is true for regulators. So, I mean, I know what Andrew means, but I think you're going to need both. You're going to need the EU approach, which takes that horizontal approach, and you need the UK approach, which is sector specific. The most important thing you need all over the place is the capacity to sort of understand and to regulate these technologies. And actually, the white paper you were talking about, made that point explicitly. It gave more resources to regulators as well. Actually, it was only about one postdoc per regulator, I worked it out. So unfortunately, I don't think it was quite enough. But, that's what you need. You need that capacity. And we're going to need it right across the public sector.
I'm going to use my prerogative to add my two cents on this education question, because it is a very real thing to figure out long term. I mean, you asked about grades, but long term, is our intelligence going to decline, or is it going to rise as a result of having AI as an assisted tool? Intelligence has been rising over decades historically, but what will AI do when we no longer need to rely on our own critical thinking? And my personal view, and I write about this a little bit in the public policy review in my paper, is that it's the softer sciences that are under more threat for being totally disrupted by AI. And I say this because if you're a scientist developing a molecule, or if you're a computer programmer developing an algorithm, it doesn't really matter whether you are a genius researcher or whether an AI developed that molecule. That product has an innate value. It helps solve a disease, or your engineering product achieves an outcome. If you're a sociologist or a philosopher and you get a large language model to produce an argument that sounds indistinguishable from a brilliant philosopher or sociologist, you have the same problem as someone trying to pawn off a cheap copy, well, a very good copy, a brilliant copy of a Picasso versus an actual Picasso. The authenticity of the provenance of that item determines its value. So if I tell you, actually, everything I just said was written by AI and it's whispering in my ear, you'd sort of say, well, what the hell are you here for? So I think it's the softer of the social sciences in particular, and maybe the humanities, that are the most afraid. And when we have these discussions at LSE around the Department Heads Forum, and you asked which groups wanted to ban AI, it was the philosophers foremost who wanted to ban AI. Interestingly, I think we don't have time for a whole lot more questions, but let's try to take one last question.
Thank you so much. I'm Asami. I'm a student here at LSE. And when I consider government use of AI and data science, I think one of the problems is how government can get good data for that. Because it is possible to argue that government can make better decision making or better policy if government have better data set. However, for historical reason, like some countries or many countries cannot or hesitate to get like personalized data from their citizens to protect their privacy. And also government can get anonymized data, big data from private sector. However, like government should rely on them. Like, I mean, their first priority is like bet their profit. So how government can get better data for AI use and data science for policy making?
Well, I mean, obviously it's a real challenge. I mean, one of the things, sorry, this is a bit of a boring answer, but one of the things is redeveloping those systems from the 70s, 80s, you know, some of them or even earlier, some of them which are still in play. I mean, the Police National Computer, for example, was one of the earliest systems in government that's currently being replaced with a kind of system that will yield, which will yield data. It still won't be easy. There are all the kind of constraints that several of us have mentioned and you've mentioned. But that is one of the things that have to be done. Also, it comes back to this capacity point. It is happening a bit with cloud computing, but departments have to kind of get their own data back from the systems integrators, where they really kind of had it locked up in very long-term, high-value contracts. With respect to private sector data, I mean, a lot of companies actually during the pandemic did share some data with government, you know, mobile phone companies and retail companies. And there's some data that I believe the ONS still have access to, will be able to use going forward. So that's one hopeful thing. One thing I would point out, though, because I'm sure there must be lots of social scientists here. One of the reasons the social scientists were so excited about sort of data science and data in the beginning was that the idea of having social media data. Data from big platforms that would help you to understand society in new ways. And that we really do not have. In fact, we have less of it than we used to have because X closed the interface, so you can't get, Musk closed X's interface. So you can't
you can't get hold of that anymore. And actually getting any data from social media companies is very, very hard, not to say impossible. And that's something I can't see a solution to unless anybody's got any bright ideas or works for Meta.
And these companies have more data in most cases than governments and fewer restrictions on their use. And we're very jealous of the access to that data. Would you like to add anything? Yes?
Can I just respond to your very provocative statement about the humanistic, like the social sciences and like management type subjects going out of fashion because of data? I see the clear opposite. What we found in the project is that actually students who are on qualitative courses like management, they found the use of Gen AI less useful than students on data focused courses, quantitative courses. And if anything, we will need in the future when we will have machines directing our world is humanity. We'll need empathy. We'll have to have critical thinking, we'll have curiosity, humor, a lot of things that actually AI does not have and will not have, especially if we are thinking about the data that it's trained on. So yes, these things will improve, and but I think overall in the future, I feel that the future will need even more of us thinking about these social dynamics and the human side of how we are operating our systems, because at the end of the day, I hope that it will be always the humans who make the decisions. So just wanted to give that.
Well, I view AI as our retirement plan, because we're of a generation that learned critical thinking pre-AI. So we'll be like the COBOL programmers who programmed bank systems in the 1970s, and then this year 2000 bug, when everyone thought the systems were going to crash, they pulled these people out of retirement because they were the only ones who understood this language that none of the younger generation knew. So we'll know critical thinking without AI because we learned that, but long term, what will happen? It is an open question. Will these skills atrophy or not? And we definitely have a challenge in the educational sector of how to adapt our teaching and learning, because it is going to change fundamentally. And these systems and all the flaws that we point to in these systems, who knows what GPT-5 will look like? A 6, 10.
It won't be much better than GPT-4.
Well, I am much more blown away by AI, maybe. But I'm a technologist. So. I don't want it to replace emotion, but in terms of critical thinking, it can do a pretty reasonable approximation, in my view. We could debate this all evening. I want to thank your...
It's not fair to do that as the chair when there's no time left.
I know. That's why it's fun to be chair. Anyway, thank you all for coming, and thank you so much to our panelists, and to Chloe.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.